calculation is dominated by short-range correlations very close in the vicinity of our entangling surface. And so to make sense of the result, we have to introduce some kind of UV regulator. And I'll be talking about, well, I'll be talking about it in terms of a shortest distance or a short distance cutoff. And if we have a scale here, R, that characterizes this geometry, then the answer that would come out would take this form here. It would be powers of the ratio of that geometric scale to the cutoff scale, and there'd be some kind of series. And these powers are important. That D, though, is the dimension of the space-time. So we live in four space-time dimensions, and so this power would start with R squared. Now, in fact, if you look more carefully at each of these terms, what you find is that they have a geometric interpretation. So this isn't just R squared or R to this power. That would actually be proportional to the area of our surface, and there'd be some dimensionless constant. And so that's like saying there's some universal contribution along this boundary of these short-range correlations. This term here has two less powers of R, but again, I can interpret that as an integral of some kind of curvatures over that boundary, and then you get curvature squared, et cetera, et cetera. Now, there's one small problem with all of that, in that I lied to you, or I used an inappropriate word when I said the word universal. In fact, these coefficients here or in that other expression are not universal. And so they depend on the regulator that I chose. So if I did the calculation or Luis did the calculation, in general, if we choose different regulators, we would get different numbers here than here. However, if we persist in calculating to higher orders, at sufficiently high order, you do get some coefficients that give us universal information that characterizes the underlying quantum field theories. And so if we one example that we'll see is if we calculate here to sufficiently high orders, sometimes we run into a logarithm, and this coefficient is known, or in many cases, in some cases, we understand precisely what this coefficient is, and it's telling us about the underlying quantum field theory. So, some more general comments. Well, this comment is, way back when, on the first transparency, I used the word measure, but there isn't really a measurement that we know about that we can go to the lab and ask our experimental friends to measure the entanglement entropy. However, we're theorists, and that doesn't stop us. So in condensed matter, it's used as a diagnostic to characterize different phases or different critical points. In quantum information, well, entanglement is a resource, and so again, it's a useful tool to characterize that resource. As a particle physicist, though, if I go back and I ask, where did entanglement entropy come from? It actually came from a gentleman in the building, Raphael Sorkin, and what he was trying to understand was black hole entropy. And in black holes, there's a natural surface that divides, in fact, the space-time into pieces, namely the event horizon. And he suggested that one could do or understand that entropy in terms of, something that we would now recognize as the entanglement entropy. I said that the leading terms in the expansion had an gave us an entropy that went like the area of the surface. And so one could imagine that this cutoff, if it was around the Planck scale in our theory of gravity, then this would look like the Bekenstein-Hawking formula for the entropy of a black hole. And so, actually, Raphael's original suggestion was made in a conference proceedings back in '84, they followed it up with some concrete calculations here, and then there's a, was independently rediscovered by Mark Sernicki, and I believe these gentlemen, some, I don't know, 5 years later, in the early 90s, and then there was a long story. Unfortunately, that story hasn't quite been resolved. And we kind of understand where it stands, that this is a contribution to the black hole entropy, but we don't really understand it. We should think that, that the entire black hole entropy should be understood in this way. Although it's not the topic of today's talk, but I think there, this is a topic that is coming back. It's something that people are thinking about. What I will talk about, I don't know why I put that red line there. What I will talk about instead is that this idea about 6 years ago also came into the discussion of holographic theory for the ABS-CFT. And so now we're making our transition to discussions of holography. And so this is my lightning review. So we have ABS-CFT. On the one side, we have, on the boundary, a quantum field theory in D dimensions, D space-time dimensions. It's a special quantum field theory in that it's a quantum field theory without any intrinsic scale, even at the quantum level. And that's what, of course, we call a conformal field theory, and that's the CFT. On the other side, we're talking about gravity with a negative cosmological constant in D plus one dimension. The simplest solution of this kind of gravity theory is a space or a geometry known as anti-de Sitter space, and that's the ADS then of ADS-CFT. This is, I have to keep reminding myself that this is more than remarkable. This statement of that equivalence is bordering on insane. However, it's an identification that we've had or that we've been playing with for nearly 20 years now. And it's something where we can't prove it, but it's a conjecture that survived the scrutiny of, thousands of papers, or alternatively of thousands of tests of these ideas, and it still seems to hang together. One of the comments is that here we had a theory in D dimensions, here we have a theory in D plus one dimensions, and that's why we throw around the word holographic or holography, because of that, the extension. When I, on one side of the equivalence, I have one less dimension than on the other side. And so one of the simple questions you might ask, and an idea that will play a role in subsequent transparencies, is why did I need an extra dimension in the first place? And there's really some kind of equivalence here between the extra dimension, or moving in the extra dimension, and moving in energy scales. And so roughly, when we're probing this geometry or gravitational degrees of freedom deep in the interior at small radius, what we're doing is we're probing infrared degrees of freedom in the boundary conformal field theory. And if I go to probe geometric or gravitational degrees of freedom at large radius, in fact, what I'm doing, or the dictionary tells me that I'm probing UV, or short distance degrees of freedom, in the boundary conformal field theory. So with 2 minutes discussion, you all know everything you have to know about the ABS-CFT, but I will pause and remind you that you are allowed to ask questions. No questions. Okay. Well, what I said is we have a quantum field theory. In particular, we have this boundary conformal field theory, and so I can draw my picture here. And I can ask, in that particular theory, what is the entanglement entropy between my region A and B? But to really make use of this correspondence, or this equivalence of these two different languages, what I'd like to do is, rather than try and just do this difficult calculation in the quantum field theory, I want to translate this to a geometric or a gravitational question. And so in that context, this picture lives out at the boundary out at r equals infinity. And in my cartoon, this empty space down here would be the bulk or the rest of the interior of the anti-de-Sitter space-time. And so the question is, in this gravitational language, how do I calculate that entanglement entropy? And these two gentlemen made a proposal some 6 years ago, and their proposal was that I should think about all of the surfaces that hang down into the bulk of the space-time, but who connect up with the entangling surface out at r equals infinity. Then what I should do for each one of the surfaces in that class is I should evaluate the area divided by 4 times Newton's constant, and I should extremize, or in the Euclidean it's actually minimize, this particular quantity, and that minimum value will be then the entanglement entropy. Now, that's a beautiful idea, and it kind of has the right flavor in that, you know, this quantity is what I was talking about before. It looks like the black hole entropy, and so it has that entropy flavor. One of the questions you might ask is, in my cartoon, why isn't the minimal surface just stretched flat across here? And you should think that it's, one way to think of it is that it's like a soap bubble. There's a gravitational potential in the ADS space that pulls everything down. And so the minimal surface actually gets pulled down by that potential, by the redshift, by the geometry. So the minimal surface actually stretches down. There's less area down here than there is in stretching across up there. Beautiful idea, small problem. If I try and evaluate that area, in fact, I get an infinity. And that's kind of obvious. I told you that this picture extends out to r equals infinity. And so if I'm trying to evaluate the entropy or the area, I have to integrate out to infinity. And of course, the area is infinite. However, that's not a bug, it's a feature, because I told you before, when I'm calculating entanglement entropy in a quantum field theory, I should expect to get an infinite answer, unless I regulate the calculation in some way. And in fact, it's a divergence where we might have expected it, and that we talked about UV divergences before, and what I'm saying here is that the divergence has to do with there being too much stuff out at the UV end of this integral, or at the large radius end of the integral. So how do we regulate it? Well, it's simple. If going to infinity is too far, well, we should stop somewhere at some large radius. And although that seems rather facetious, that's actually a tried and true procedure. In fact, when we do any calculations in ADS-CFT, we always introduce some kind of regulator surface because we're always running into various kinds of infinities. And something that we know is that introducing a cutoff surface at some large radius is equivalent to introducing a short distance cutoff in the boundary conformal field theory. And the larger this radius is here, the smaller this short distance cutoff is here. We need some conversion constant, and that L squared is just the curvature scale of the ADS space. And so that's part of, well, the dictionary that we already knew, or had already been established in translating between conformal field theory and bulk gravity. So if you regulate things, we're going to get a finite answer, and it's relatively easy to show that to leading order, what you get is something that looks like the area law. So here's the area of my entangling surface. Here's the cutoff to the appropriate power. And then there's a prefactor that's basically the ratio of the ADS scale to the Planck scale this own particular power. And that's something, again, that our ADS-CFP dictionary tells us is something that's related to the central charge of the boundary conformal field theory, or alternatively, we can just say that this is a quantity that's known, and it's something that roughly at least counts the number of degrees of freedom in our boundary theory. And so, for example, in a famous case or a well-known case, namely when we talk about ADS-5 and a four-dimensional boundary theory that's n equals 4 super Yang nil, this ratio gives us something like n squared, the square of the rank of the gauge. Okay, so there's the area law. We can persist, we can calculate harder, we find that there's some kind of expansion of the form that I described before, and if we persist the high enough order, we'll be able to identify universal coefficients in the entanglement entropy as well. As I said, this idea, it's a nice idea, but it got pulled out of a hat. It wasn't something that was derived. And so it's a conjecture, but what one has done, or what has been done, is that that conjecture has been tested by various consistency tests. And I'm just going to, well, I'm going to cut that part short. In a regular talk, I have half a dozen transparencies talking about different consistency tests. But here, one simple one is that, you know, we get this area law that was more or less expected in this context. Another one is that two-dimensional conformal field theories, there we've got a lot more symmetry and we've got a lot more control. And so these gentlemen did some calculations of entanglement entropy before there was, well, I guess there was ADS-CFP, but outside of ADS-CFP, just in the context using the tools of two-dimensional conformal field theory, and they came up with a result like this. What does that say? Well, it says, take my time slice for the two-dimensional theory, so that's just a line now, compactify it on a circle, choose my region A to be a segment on that circle of length L, and then the entanglement entropy takes this form. I get the sine of this ratio of L to the total circumference, and then that's multiplied by the total circumference over the cutoff scale. There's some factors of pi there, and then the coefficient here is precisely the central charge of the two-dimensional conformal field theory divided by 3. And that's a result, then, that one can reproduce precisely using this approach or this Rue Takinagi prescription up there. What I would be doing is I'd be doing a calculation in ADS-3 or three-dimensional anti-de-Sitter space, and I've got then a two-dimensional boundary where the two-dimensional CFP lives. And there's a similar formula I'm not going to show you having to do with a calculation for thermal ensembles. And as I said, there are many more tests. So this is something, again, that's been looked at quite a bit and survived quite a bit of scrutiny. But it, as it stands, it's a conjecture. And that actually is the introduction to holographic entanglement entropy. So again, I will pause and ask you if you have any questions. Paul looks like he does.
Well, yeah, it was sort of related to something I was wondering about. But so they did 2D CFT and they did it when there's a finite correlation matrix. But they didn't do sort of a flow that takes you from one CFT to another CFT. Like, and that's the sign.
These gentlemen didn't do that. No.
I just wonder if anyone had done that for that. It's a bit irrelevant.
There's actually a very interesting story, and unfortunately not the topic of today's seminar, but what Cassini and Huerta did in the mid-2000s is they actually rephrased the Damoulas-Jacob seep theorem in terms of a discussion of entanglement entropy. Mm-hmm. us. I mean, they, in their context, you weren't looking at a compactified thing, but you were looking at a segment. And then you asked how the, basically the pre-factor of the logarithm varied as you varied the size of your segment. And that was, then what you're doing with that is you're probing different scales. And you're seeing a flow, and it's a monotonic flow. So it, there is actually an interesting story there. Okay, so I'm just going to jump to Rainy entropies, but I will try and make that transition by saying it's terribly annoying that we can't just derive this. And so to understand that better, we'd like to understand why it would be so hard to derive this expression for holographic entanglement entropy. And to do that, though, we have to take a look at something called Rainy entropies. So this was something, I think, that was invented in the beginning of the 70s by a mathematician called Rainy. And so he invented a family of different measures of correlation. However, one of the things he did here, well, he's taking now the trace of powers of this density matrix, throwing in a logarithm. But he also threw in this factor because he wanted to connect this to entanglement entropy. And so formally, if I can take arbitrary or real values for that index, and I take the limit alpha goes to 1, in fact, this expression reduces to the trace rho log rho that we had before.
So there's no physical, you seem to feel like the component entropy has a physical content because it's just the ultimate entropy of the unknowns of the probability.
Yeah.
So that's physically motivated. The ring entropy, it's more of a mathematical device. Is it that it's easy to calculate, or does it have some real physical interpretation on its own?
Well, I'm going to say here that it's become a standard part. This is sort of seen as a standard approach to calculating entanglement entropy. And that's actually how Cardi and Calabresi came at it. And it's essentially what you said. It's easier to deal with powers of the density matrix here rather than that logarithm of the density matrix.
So isn't this the partition function? If instead of calling it alpha, you call it beta. Isn't this just zero beta, and then that's the standard formula for computing the entropy once you know the partition function?
It will be in special cases, but not in general. I mean, in general, Rainy was more interested in, I think, communications and sort of, so he never talked about actually von Neumann entropy, he talked about the Shannon entropy. Mm-hmm. And in fact, I have the, if you want to see the first page of his, his paper, it's hidden deep. But he was, I mean, it was more a mathematical exercise for him. He said there, given a certain set of conditions, there's a unique measure of correlations or information that satisfies those conditions, and that was the one known for the Shannon entropy. And then he basically said, but I can replace this last condition by a new substitute, and that widened the family then to include all of these as well as the Shannon. But I have to confess, I never really understood in the context that I'm thinking what these conditions really mean. So I don't really have any physical insight into why he chose that. Do I just yawn?
No.
So this is sort of seen as a standard approach to calculating entanglement entropy. Some other interesting features are you can take other limits. In particular, if you take alpha goes to infinity, then this is going to be dominated by the largest eigenvalue. And so you get an expression like this, where that's the largest eigenvalue of the density matrix. Alternatively, if you go to alpha equals zero, everybody contributes more or less the same. And so you get something about the dimension of the space or the number of non-vanishing eigenvalues. Again, we can look for examples. So this goes back to Cardi and Calabrese, and actually these gentlemen here did it, at least 6 years earlier, but in a very different context. So this is for two-dimensional conformal field theories. Now I'm just looking at an interval on a line. And what you find is an expression like this. Here's a logarithm that we saw before. There's a simple prefactor that depends on alpha, and then this is the central charge now divided by 6. And you can verify that if I stick alpha equals 1 in there, I get a C over 3 times the logarithm. And that's somewhat simpler, but that's the limit of the case where the circumference goes to infinity of that expression that I had before. However, once you go to two intervals, and various people have looked at that, this Rainey entropy becomes considerably more complicated. It doesn't have a simple universal form that, say, only depends on the central charge. You actually need a lot more information. You need to know the entire spectrum. And in fact, that's a case where they've got formulas that they can write down for any n, but they don't know how to analytically continue those expressions to get the entanglement entropy at n equals 1 from them.
Any dimension here? What's that?
Oh, I'm sorry. Yeah. No, n was alpha. So I'm not sure why, but it's the n is the index on the Rainey entropy there. And if you go to larger dimensions, well, it's a topic of interest, and so there's a growing number of examples. There's an early paper by Subir and friends, Max Politsky here. There's also our friends across the way do numerical calculations of some of the low line, or some of the low alpha Rainey entropies. But again, I would say that this is another demanding set of calculations. It's not simple to see, or it's one of these things where it's not simple to see the forest or the trees. Given a certain problem, you have to bang away at it. And so far, we don't see simple universal expressions emerging from that. A little bit more about the kind of calculation that we're doing there. This is the basic setup. We've seen it before. We introduce some entangling surface. We want to integrate out or trace over degrees of freedom here, take that density matrix and plug it into this formula. But there's a path integral realization of that calculation. And so at step 0 in the calculation, what we're doing is we're going to the Euclidean. And then, the typical calculation one does is to evaluate this for the ground state. And so the idea is to represent the ground state wave function here as a path integral, where we have some more or less arbitrary boundary conditions at minus infinity. We do the path integral up to this time slice, and the thing that survives will be the representative of the ground state wave function. And I've divided it up. This would be an argument of the field configuration on our t equals 0 slice, but I've just divided it up. We're going to have the region and the complement, and then this is our entangling surface, and so there's the field in the region B and the field in the region A. I take the adjoint, so now I've got the opposite integral from plus infinity down. I get a similar expression here on t equals 0 slice. To form the density matrix, what I do is I take the wave function adjoint, and I trace over the degrees of freedom in the region B, i.e., I extend my path integral to include a path integral over those degrees of freedom. And that then gives me a density matrix. It has two arguments, both fields in region A, but there's one set of fields on a little sliver or on a time slice here that I find by approaching it from t equals, well, from I'm approaching t equals 0 from below, and I'm approaching here t equals 0 from above. So we've integrated out, or we've extended our path integral to include that, but we've left the boundary conditions above and below. Well, those are the arguments for the density matrix. Then I want to take powers of the density matrix, so I make many copies of that. Here I've got 3 copies. And what I'm supposed to do is take the trace of 3 copies. But that just means then that I'm connecting these various boundary conditions in the appropriate way. So here, the 0 minus gets connected or identified with the 0 plus. Here, the 0 minus gets connected with 0 plus on that copy, et cetera, et cetera. So that it turns into a trace. And so now what we're doing is we're doing a path integral over this n-fold copy of the original geometry. But we've introduced these funny boundary conditions in it, so that there is a singularity on the entangling surface there. If I run around that entangling surface, there is, I run around n times before I get back to where I started. So there's an angular deficit of minus whatever, 2 pi n minus 1. Alternatively, a language that was introduced, I think, by Cardi and Calabresi is to think of it as I have n copies of my field theory, but I've introduced an operator called the twist operator that creates these funny boundary conditions as we go around the twist operator. So it connects up the different copies of the fields as we move around it. And so that's actually something that I'll talk about briefly towards the end. In any event, what we see is that, well, there is a path integral representation of, this power of the density matrix, but it involves a path integral over some singular space for an n-fold cover of our original theory, or our original space-time. Now, in holography, the idea was we translate our field theory questions into gravitational and geometric questions. And so the problem is that we've got this issue with the geometry and the boundary, the singularity, and how do we deal with that singularity in our bulk gravitational theory? And so Forsyev made a bold proposal, which is that singularity actually extends into the bulk space-time, and you think of it as, well, an object that lives there, and that somehow we can effectively extremize over that as part of the gravity path integral. The only problem with that idea is that you get the wrong answer, as was shown by Matt Hedrick. And what Matt proposed in the same paper was that, in fact, what we have to do, or what we should do, is we should take advantage of the conformal symmetry, basically to unwind or unwrap the geometry around that singular place, around the twist operator. Then we'll have a smooth boundary metric. But essentially, that gives us some kind of funny boundary conditions for our gravitational theory, and so the challenge is that we have to find some kind of smooth bulk solution for our gravitational equations of motion, given these boundary conditions of this unwrapped or this funny manifold out at infinity. And somewhat facetiously, I say here, it's simple in two dimensions. It turns out that, well, in two dimensions, any sort of boundary dimension is 2. In that case, all of the metrics, or any metric in two dimensions, is conformally flat, and so it's somewhat easier to do this smoothing out. And at the same time, all of the bulk solutions are always ADS3, or pieces of ADS3, and so he was able to show well, to actually explicitly carry out these calculations, at least for some simple examples, yeah, with E equals 2 and ADS 3 in the bulk. No?
Just a little bit more technical, what do we mean by sort of smoothing out the boundary? I mean, is there a conical deficit still, or can you lose that? If so, how do you get
rid of it? No, I'm going to do something simple-minded, like, well, it, yeah, it's not quite the simple-minded, but the simple-minded one would be that I had some branch point in one of my pictures, and so there's, well, yeah, if I go around there, there's this conical, well, it's actually a conical excess there. But if I go to some new coordinate, so if this was the bed plane, if I go to some new coordinates that are y equals, let's see, z to the 1 over n, then I've kind of unwound that singularity. And so in the y plane, I've smoothed it out. It's a coordinate change, but then there's I'm not going to get it right. There's a pre-factor, the conformal factor that sits out in front of the metric.
Yep.
All I do is a coordinate change, but if we are in a conformal field theory, then I can do a Weyl rescaling to basically strip off that pre-factor. And in this case, it would take me then to a new metric that's just last bit.
Yeah, so it's really hard.
Yeah. So that's a little bit too quick. I mean, it's not that much too quick, but if you had a single interval and you have to work a little bit harder to get rid of both singularities to make sure everything works out. And if you're really interested, that's how they disappeared. Cardi and Calabresi, actually, you know, that's what they started with, doing these calculations. And there's a long, boring discussion in our paper where we do that holographically, and I'm not going to bother interrupting anybody. But, because, yeah, it's, well, at the end of the day, you find it terribly insightful. And what I'm going to do instead is I'm going to present to you another calculation of entanglement entropy. But the goal is really to find a calculation of entanglement entropy that has a very simple translation to a holographic context. However, the footnote here is that, you know, that's the way we phrase the discussion, but at the end of the day, what we're really doing is realizing Matt's slogan here, smoothing things out in Ohm's law. We'll see that again when we come back to the twist operators at the end. Okay, so now I'm going to tell you a story again. It's a story in quantum field theory. It has nothing to do with holography, and we'll see in a couple of transparencies we reintroduce holography. But this is a story just about quantum field theory. And what I'm going to do, though, to make progress is I'm going to specialize. I'm not going to do the most general calculation of entanglement entropy or Rayleigh entropy. In fact, we're going to focus on entanglement entropy here. And the two things that I'm doing is, one, I'm going to focus my attention on conformal field theory. And that's because, again, I have holography in the back of my mind. And the other thing I'm going to do is, for the entangling surface, I'm going to pick a very special surface. I'm going to pick a sphere of the appropriate dimension. And that sphere carries some radius r. And the first observation is that the density matrix that we get in this problem, I presented it as something that encodes, for instance, correlators in this region A. But in fact, by causality, that density matrix actually describes physics over what I'll call the causal domain, or the causal development of A. So that means that I've got, you know, if I had initial data on my slice on my region A and I evolved it forward, I could evolve it forward into that region, or if I evolved it backwards, I could evolve it in that region there. So do we get the idea of what the causal domain is? But the thing is that now, rather than thinking about a small region on a slice of the space, I'm thinking about a volume of the space-time. And so now we might think about, since we have a conformal field theory, we'll do a conformal transformation. And so there is a clever conformal transformation that one can come up with, which takes this causal domain to a new space, where the geometry and the spatial slices are now hyperbolic planes, and then there's time that just sits there. And essentially what that conformal transformation does is it blows up this region to be the entire space. And so I threw away the rest of the space, and now this actually would be the Penrose diagram for this new geometry here. So it's a conformally compactified picture of this new geometry. In fact, what we've done is we've pushed the boundary out to infinity. And these are scribe plus, and scribe minus, light-like infinity, and the light-like past boundaries of this space-time. In pushing it out to infinity, it seems that I've lost track of the one scale and the problem R. But of course, the problem, well, this geometry remembered about that scale because it's actually now the curvature scale of those hyperbolic planes. But there's now a miracle in that the problem actually remembers about that scale in another way, which is that if I started with a vacuum in flat space and I go through this step or this conformal transformation, I actually end up with a thermal bath in this new geometry. And of course, there's only one scale in the problem, and so the temperature here is also related to R, and it's in fact 1 over 2 pi times that original radius. It's a conformal field theory, and so this is a mapping of, you know, one description of the physics to another description of the physics. And so the density matrix that we were talking about before becomes the thermal density matrix of our thermal bath. There's some unitaries that get us from one side of the mapping to the other, but the von Neumann entropy doesn't care about those unitaries. And so what we've done is we've translated our entanglement entropy to a thermal entropy in this new context here.
Question?
Yeah.
So we know that the entanglement entropy is divergent. Why the thermal one is divergent?
Patience. So again, this is what we did. We started with a hard problem of calculating the entanglement entropy, and we translated it to another hard problem of calculating the thermal entropy in some funny space where the curvature scale and the temperature are basically the same order. However, as was commented, there's a UV divergence that I went on and on about in the entanglement entropy. And so, in fact, there's also a divergence on the other side. The other side, what the divergence is that I have a fixed entropy density, but I've got an infinite spatial slice, and so when I try and sum up all of the entropy, again, I get an infinity, but now it looks like an infrared divergence. And so, you know, this is really saying infinity equals infinity unless I regulate both of those calculations. And so to make sense of the equality, we have to be careful about that, and we have to follow the regulator through the conformal mapping. And a somewhat, we won't exactly do this, but a quick way to think of it is if there was a short distance cutoff that I introduced in the original problem. We were throwing away these correlations very close to the boundary. But that then gets mapped to an infrared cutoff. When I'm summing up this thermal entropy, I only integrate out to some maximum radius here. And we'll see, or one can show or find, that there's a relation then between this maximum radius and this short distance cutoff in the original problem. And, well, I guess I've done it in a way that this is a dimensionless radius. We'll see later. And, well,
this R and then comes into a translation. But that's an important part to make, this equality says infinity equals infinity, and so to make sense of it, we have to make sure that we're doing things in a sensible way for that equality to hold. So again, this is what we've done so far, and now we go to holography. The whole point was to find something that translates easily in holography. And the point is that when I have thermal, I can go to the ADS-CFP dictionary, and it tells me that a thermal ensemble in the CFP is equivalent to having some kind of black hole in our bulk geometry or in the anti-de-Sitter space. And so I get to extend this equality by one more step. Now I have the entanglement entropy that I was originally hunting. That became a thermal entropy here. But then I'll use holography to translate that to a horizon entropy in the gravitational problem. And so all I have to do is find the appropriate black hole. And the clue really comes from this hyperbolic geometry there. There are a set of black holes that have hyperbolic geometries, or the horizons are hyperbolic. They're typically known as topological black hole, and they have some interesting, story that many people, including Rob Mann here, talk about. And it's one of the interesting aspects is those hyperbolic horizons are actually infinite in size. And when I think about my ADS geometry, this is supposed to be, this circle or disk is supposed to represent a time slice in my ADS, and what you find is that the horizon extends all the way to infinity. And so what I'm going to do is I'm going to find the black hole such that the horizon sort of connects up, or that's the edge of this region A. The story is a little bit more subtle in that what we find is that the black hole that I wanted actually isn't really a black hole, it's just a funny coordinate system on ADS space. So here's a standard coordinate system known as Poincaré coordinates on ADS space. I would use those coordinates if I wanted to talk about the CFP in flat space, and these would be the flat gauge theory directions, or that would those would be the coordinates of the flat space. This is Z is my radius. But then it turns out I can do a clever coordinate transformation that takes me to this set of coordinates. That's the same geometry, it's still ADF space. But now what we see is that there's a place, rho is now the radius, but there's a place where GTT or G tau tau goes to zero. And so that looks like a horizon. And you can ask what the temperature of that horizon is. And it turns out that it's just precisely this T over 1 over 2 pi r, T equals 1 over 2 pi r, which is what we talked about before in the conformal field theory story.
Maybe this is just some separated observer or something like that, because of course it's just locally against
it. Yeah, so down here, This is really like finding some set of Rindler coordinates on ADS space, and what I'm doing, the entire ADS space-time now went from being a disk to the cylinder, but what we're doing with this coordinate system is we're finding something that actually only covers these wedges, and so that's like Rindler coordinates in a Minkowski space, but now we're doing it in ADS space. The other idea here is that with hindsight, that's a story that we might have anticipated in that we're used to the idea that we're dealing with a boundary theory where we have where we can do these conformal transformations in an interesting way. But we're used to the idea that the way we implement those conformal transformations in the boundary theory is with coordinate transformations in the bulk geometry. And so that's precisely what I did. I did some coordinate transformation in the bulk, but what it's doing is implementing this the desired conformal transformation that I talked about before in the boundary conformal field theory. Okay, so, well, now what I can do is I can just evaluate the entropy of the horizon. And in fact, you can generalize the problem. In Einstein gravity, I would have just evaluated A over 4G. And you can imagine that I could have more general theories of gravity and that they would have an ABS vacuum. And in that case, what I would do is I would evaluate Wald's entropy, or a quantity known as Wald's entropy. And what we do there is you take the gravitational Lagrangian, and you do some kind of manipulation where you take essentially a derivative or a functional variation with respect to curvature. You have to tie up the indices with some extra tensors over here, and that's a quantity then that you integrate over the horizon. So in Einstein gravity, that's just a fancy way to write A over 4G, but in more general context, that gives you something that evaluates the horizon entropy for higher curvature theories of gravity. And the answer comes out to take this form here. There's some annoying numerical factor that I stuck in there. There's a coefficient here where what I'm doing is I'm hiding all of the interesting gravitational coupling in that coefficient, and then this is the area, essentially the area. And so, again, as an example, in Einstein gravity, this gives us just the ratio of the ABS scale to the Planck scale, or it gives us the ABS scale to some power over Newton's constant. And so that's what I would get in Einstein gravity. More generally, what you can show is that this quantity is related to a particular central charge in the case where the boundary CFT is even dimensional. And so it's something called the A-type trace anomaly. So it's a particular quantity that appears in even dimensional conformal field theories. And you can show that there's though a direct translation between the quantities that I get out of this manipulation and the quantity that I would have got if I evaluated the trace anomaly for a particular gravitational theory.
Sorry, are you saying that this is only valid in even dimensions? Or
this statement is only valid in even dimensions.
But that formula would still be there in odd dimensions?
Yeah, in odd dimensions, that formula is still there. Question is, what is that quantity? And it turns out that that quantity, well, one of the what didn't an idea is we show that this plays the role or appears as the universal contribution in the entanglement entropy. That was sort of the story we were telling when we were calculating an entanglement entropy. And so actually this applies for this statement that it appears as the universal coefficient applies either for even or odd dimensions. But in odd dimensions, it plays the role effectively of a central charge. And so there's this story about our G flows and C theorems. And so this is the quantity that satisfies the C theorem. So we didn't quite finish the job though. There's this area here. We have to integrate over this hyperbolic plane that is the horizon. I've written some coordinate system. Again, that's where the infinity is. How do we figure that out? Well, I said what we're going to do is we're going to stop at some maximum radius. But how we choose that maximum radius is we go back to the original problem. And remember I said that to make sense of entanglement entropy or any calculations in ABS CFT, we needed to introduce a regulator surface. And so there's some surface out here in the original problem implicitly at large radius in the ABS space. And so what we're going to do is we're going to integrate along the horizon out to the cutoff surface. And that's going to define our new max. And if you do that, what you find is that there's some expression here that's basically the radius of the original sphere that we had over the new cutoff, or of the cutoff defined by this surface delta. And there's an appropriate power here, so that this is really just the area law for our sphere in our d-dimensional CFT. That's essentially what that is. And then the coefficient here is given by that magic number that we talked about. I said, though, that that wasn't something I would recognize as a universal term, but if we persist and calculate the higher orders, what you find is that there's a log term in unit dimensions of a constant term in odd dimensions. And the coefficient there, again, that was just an overall coefficient. So we can recognize that these universal coefficients are also proportional to that quantity there. So some other comments. Well, yeah, you can do this in a slightly different context. It's interesting to compare. What I did is I told you a story and then I translated it to holography, and so in some sense we have a derivation of the entanglement entropy for this particular class of problems. And you can show that that surface, that horizon that we picked out, that sort of Rindler horizon that we picked out, actually coincides with the surface that the ruined Takinagi prescription would have picked out. Although the way we attacked the problem, there wasn't any question or any step where we were really applying some kind of extremization procedure. And so these two stories really are very different. To contrast them further, in our story, we can deal with any classical theory of gravity in the bulk. In particular, we can include lots of higher curvature terms. But we're restricted. We can only talk about spherical entangling surfaces. On the other hand, Ruin Takinagi can deal with any kind of entangling surface, but they can only deal with Einstein gravity in the bulk. And there's a question here, you know, if I thought that this was sort of the leading order answer to the question of entanglement entropy, in the Rue Takinagi prescription, I don't really know how to go about thinking about what are the corrections to this leading order answer. In this way that we presented the problem, you could ask, you know, what are the corrections? And in principle, you can imagine, I emphasize imagine, calculating quantum corrections. And I imagine that they appear sort of through the Hawking radiation, or the radiation associated with the horizon. But this really isn't a calculation. At least at present, that I see as a feasible one. So I really, I'll pause again and take a drink. Are there any questions? A question.
A question on S-thermal is equal to S-horizon. Now, on the gravitational side of the horizon, I would expect that heat capacity is negative because gravity is attractive. But on the other side, on the thermal side, I just have an ordinary quantum field theory at finite temperature, so the heat capacity should be positive. So,
So there's an interesting story there, and it applies more generally than this, you know, discussion of entanglement entropy and all the hyperbolic horizons. But what you find is, let me see, so this is the temperature and this is the mass or radius of the black hole. Size of the black hole. What you find is that when the black holes are very, very small, then they don't know that they're in AES space. Mm-hmm. And so, as you said, you know, you get a curve here that looks like the curve that I would see for an asymptotically flat black hole. Mm-hmm. However, at a certain point, the black hole gets big enough, it starts to realize that it's an AES space. And what happens then is that this curve. So these black holes are unstable, but the curve then turns around and heads up. And so there's actually a family of stable black holes over here, and those are the ones that are really properly the saddle point that describes a thermal bath in the boundary theory. So that, yeah, these are some saddle points in the path integral that have to do with tunneling, but these are really the ones that dominate and describe the thermal bath that we talked about. And because of that curve is going up, it's positive.
For big black holes.
For big black holes. And this is happening with this book. It turns around again around the time that it sees the curvature scale, and it realizes it's the black hole realizes it's in ABF.
Did Paul have
it?
It's quite surprising that your bifurcation set maps onto this minimal surface. And I'm just sort of wondering how generally you understood why that happened and how many cases you do general dimension that keeps that symmetry check with those.
There's some real magic that happens that's happening there. In general, one way to describe the magic is that, this mapping led us to a thermal bath. And in general, when you think about other shapes, other entangling surfaces, you can imagine doing conformal mappings like that that kind of blow the, take the causal development of the causal domain and blow it up to infinite size. The problem is that typically, though, the geometry isn't very nice, it's time dependent. And I don't have any idea what the state of the CFT, I don't have any idea what, maybe someone else does, but I don't know what the state of the CFT is in this new geometry. And so there's no, picking a sphere does something really magical for you that in general you don't see. Of course, it should also be said, I told this nice story where I started with CFTs and I ended up with a calculation in holography. In fact, what happened is we were doing holographic calculations and messing around and worked our way backwards. And so it's really holography led us to this story, or that's the way we came upon it. And so somehow, having a thermal bath with a black hole there, it just somehow knew, or it picked out the spheres for us and told us that's the problem, she said.
How did you know that the causal domain of the sphere maps to a thermal space-time?
That actually takes some work, and you can you read the paper. There'll be a calculation that I do in the Euclidean in a little while. And if you're in the Euclidean, I like the causal domain, and that's a nice story to say, but if you're doing the calculation in the Euclidean, you start with flat space and you do this mapping, and what you end up with is actually the hyperbolic plane, but then your Euclidean time is periodically identified as a circle. And so that may be something that you remember, that when you're doing thermal field theory, that the way it is defined, or any way to define it, is by doing the Euclidean path integral with periodic boundary conditions in the Euclidean time. So there you see it more directly that this must be a thermal state or ensemble.
Okay, but that case was Lorentzian. Do you also see a rolled-up time, or is it?
Well, you implicitly see the same thing, and that if I showed you the conformal mapping, one of the things you notice is that the conformal mapping that you're doing, it has a periodicity in imaginary time, because there are cinch factors and whatnot. That's actually not enough. You have to actually work a little bit harder and think about the operators or the correlators and how the correlation functions look. But again, with a little bit of work, you can show that they are, the correlators have this periodicity in imaginary time, and that's basically the definition of having a thermal field theory. Any other questions? Okay, that was a story about entanglement entropy, but I had promised you a story about Rayleigh entropy. So remember, what Rayleigh entropy was is we took a power of the density matrix, and then there was the log and this other numerical factor. Now, in the discussion we just had, what we found was that this density, this reduced density matrix actually was related to some thermal density matrix in another problem. And so in this case, if I take a power, it's not very intimidating. What I just get is a factor of n sitting up here, and there's another one down here. So then I take a trace, and I get an expression that looks like that. This is familiar. It looks the same. What I've done here, it also looks familiar. It's just got this factor of n. And so all I've done is I've changed the temperature from the original T naught to some new temperature, T naught divided by n. And so when I study the rating entropy, I'm just studying thermal partition functions again. However, they're not all at this magical temperature of 1 over 2 pi r. You can massage that, well, you take this and stick it up here. You can massage that formula using standard, thermodynamic quantities, like call the free energy, the log of the partition function, then the Rainey entropy looks like the difference of these two free energies at different temperatures, and there's some overall factor there. I can massage that a little bit more by using the fact that the free energy and the entropy is related to the derivative of the free energy. And that expression then I can think of as an integral over entropy from this original temperature to that final temperature. That was the prefactor. And so in this formula, this is the Rainey entropy we'd like to calculate in that original problem of a spherical surface in flat space. On this side, I've got a thermal entropy in this strange new geometry. And I have to know it over a range of temperatures here so that I can do that integral. Well, before, what we did is we said all we had to know about was AES space, and it was just some kind of coordinate transformation that gave us that magic temperature. In this case, we really need to work harder and know the entropy at different temperatures or the free energy at different temperatures. And so we really have to know about these topological black hole solutions. And so that would be some general, in general, the solutions can be written in this particular way. That's some metric. But the point is that I said I could work in any old theory and it's easy to find an AES solution. It's somewhat harder to find these black hole solutions. And so I have to work in specific cases where I know how to solve the equation and determine what this factor F is here. And so one case that I know to work with is Einstein gravity. Another case, well, there's some more exotic higher curvature theories. One's called Gauss-Monnet, Lovelock, some other theory that we invented called it quasi-topological gravity. But as long as you can calculate, you can do this problem. I mean, as long as you can determine in your gravitational theory what that function is, you can do this problem. And so the simplest example is just Einstein gravity, and it turns out that the calculation that you get in general yields an answer, and here's the answer. There's some factors here. I have to solve for x, which is the root of some quadratic equation. This explicitly is the expression. So it's, somewhat a messy problem or answer. But what do we see? Well, over here we had this volume factor. We regulate that more or less in the same way. The leading order, what I get is an area law term, the power of the cutoff. If I work harder, say even dimensions, I'll find that there's a logarithm appearing in that, and there's some precise prefactor. There's also this term, these gravitational couplings. I'd like to translate my answer into an answer that is phrased in terms of the conformal field theory. And so what I can do is I can identify a particular central charge with this particular ratio of the AES scale and the Planck scale. And for those who want to know, this is a convenient central charge because it's actually defined as the central charge that appears in the leading term in the two-point expansion of the stress tensor. So that's something that I can do in any number of dimensions. See what happens when two stress tensors collide, and there's this leading C number term, and that, well, there's some coefficient that characterizes your theory, and that's what I'm calling the CT. So if I ask what's the universal term here, what I get is an expression like this. Here's my logarithm, here's my central charge, and then there's some numerical factor that depends on this expression here. And remember, because of that logarithm, that was something I did with an even boundary dimension. One of the things I can do is I can compare that answer to the answer I expected to get in two dimensions. Remember, Calabresi and Cardi did a calculation and told us what the answer had to be. It turns out that if you compare this or reduce this down to two dimensions, you get exactly this answer here. In fact, C is, we know, the central charge that appears in the two-point function of the stress tensor. So that's a good check. In general, we have a more complicated expression there, but it has, in some sense, a simple universal form. There's a central charge, there's the logarithm, and then there's some numerical factor that depends on the Rényi index, and it depends on the dimension of the space-time. And so maybe that's hinting that there's some still, relatively simple form for the Rényi entropy in these problems. Unfortunately, that expectation doesn't last long. If we look at a slightly more complicated theory, so in particular, I'm going to look at a more complicated gravitational theory, this one that I call Gauss-Bonnet. It really comes from adding a curvature squared term. This is my cosmological constant, this is the Einstein term, and here's a curvature squared term. It has a very precise form that was introduced by Lovelock. This is actually the Euler density in four dimensions. I'm doing gravity in five dimensions. If I was doing gravity in four dimensions, this would be a topological invariant. It wouldn't change the equation. But because I'm in five dimensions, this actually changes the equations of motion, but it does so in a way that they're still second-order equations, so they're not higher-order equations of motion. And it's something that string theorists have played around with in the past, and in particular in AES-CFD recently, it's used as a toy model for theories where the central charges aren't all equal. So in a general, say, four-dimensional CFD, there are two central charges, A and C. In Einstein gravity, that's the theory where lambda was zero, both of these terms would be the same. In our theory where lambda is non-zero, well, this term is not the same as that term. So it's a model theory for studying holographic conformal field theories where those two central charges are different. We can grind through all of the calculations and what we find in that case, I guess for four dimensions is the universal contribution to the Rényi entropy. There's a log that we expected. There's some numerical factors. Now x is the root of some cubic equation, which you could actually write out, although it would take several pages. And then there's some messy expressions here that involve x and both central charges, C and A. And so that kind of, well, at one level, you might think of it as disappointing because we've lost this, we had this hypothesis for a simple universal form. But we see that this function in here in general depends not only on the dimension, on the Rényi index, but also on other parameters. So here it would be the ratio of the two central charges. And if you work even harder, what you find is that other graph or other parameters in the CFP start to make an appearance here. And so, I was rather disappointed by that result. There's no universal form. On the other hand, one could think of it as an opportunity. If we manipulate this cleverly enough, perhaps it's a way to start to uncover more information about the CFD other than just some central charge, you can start to identify using rating entropies, you know, these other parameters that are messing up our simple formula. One thing to note is that while this equation looks rather complicated and it's more intimidating when you remember that x, we have to solve this cubic equation, if you actually look at the curves, they don't look that scary at all. So this is the ratio of the Rayleigh entropy and the entanglement entropy. For n equals 1, these are the same thing, so it's just a flat line. But then n equals 2, 3, these lines aren't actually straight, but they look pretty close to straight in this range of the central charges.
Why do we stop at ratio 2? I'm assuming it can go much better.
In fact, it can't. There's another story that one has to tell. If you go beyond here, what I know is I can do, I know actually that the conformal field theory is inconsistent. I start to find negative energy fluxes and funny things start to happen.
And the bulk is funny.
Sorry?
That's not funny.
You know, it's not understood as well what's going wrong in the bulk. But it's a diagnostic that I know I can bring in this conformal field theory test. It says I know something's going wrong. I can describe that whole process of what's going wrong in the bulk, but interpreting it in terms of a purely geometric or gravitational funniness or issue, that really hasn't been done.
And it's also why we stop here at, I think, 2/3 or something on this side, because there's a in conformal field theory, four-dimensional conformal field theories, I know there's a band where consistent theories live. We don't bother to explore that. So that's the end of the Rayleigh entropy story, so we'll pause again and ask if there are any questions. Actually, how long is it?
So, what was T4 in the previous slide? What's parameter in the 4D CFD?
Let's see. One way of describing it is we invented a particular theory of gravity that let us probe that, but one way of understanding it is if I look at three-point functions in a conformal field theory, they're completely fixed by conformal invariants, which means that the structure is fixed up to various constant coefficients.
Mm-hmm.
And if you take the three-point function of the stress tensor, it turns out that there are three structures, and so there are three parameters that describe a generic CFD. And so those three parameters, one way of collecting them is it's the two central, in four dimensions, it's the two central charges C and A, and then there's this third parameter that I'm calling T4. That's where that came from, although it's a somewhat longer story about that.
So do we know what T4 is? Superangles.
Sure. For superangles, A is something like n squared over pi, C over A is 1, and T4 is 0. Other questions?
So the gravity theory that has this T4 in it, is it also a order of the term?
This is
topological.
You introduce a curvature cube term. One way of thinking of it is basically a Weyl tensor cube term. And that has a lot of nice properties. So it's not obviously unstable. But you can see if you push it too hard that it starts to behave in a funny way. So I don't want to oversell it. But the reason that we designed it, or, well, yeah, we didn't say that here we'll add this term. But what we said is, let's design a theory that lets us probe this third direction in parameter space. I mean, it's something that I guess has been known for a long time, but to probe these parameters, you have to add higher curvature terms. So we're sort of taking a minimalist approach. But what we're doing is we're building toy models. We're, you know, in principle, string theory might tell us, you know, a consistent theory that has all of those parameters turned on. But at present, you know, we haven't developed string theory well enough that we can actually study that. And so this is really, you can think of it as a toy model, just to give us an indication. Okay, let's see if we can wind this up. The last topic was twist operators. So again, in this path integral representation of the Rainey entropy, we came upon some n-fold cover, but there was this singularity here. And so the Cardi and Calabresi thought of it as, well, I have n copies and I introduce a special operator that connects or intertwines the various copies of the field theory. And in their two-dimensional setting, those are just, you know, local operators. They're point-like operators with a specific scaling dimension, which is given there. And in principle, well, I can draw the pictures and tell the story. Sorry. In higher dimensions, but not a lot is known about twist operators in a higher dimensional context. I mean, the story would be that it's a codimension two operator, i.e. it's an operator that lives on a surface, namely this entangling surface. But beyond, and we know it's supposed to introduce some funny boundary conditions, but beyond that, we don't really know too much about them. And so the question is, can we use our holographic calculations to learn something new about these operators? And so this is a CFT story. This is just saying, well, if I had a twist operator and it was just a plane sitting there, one of the things I might ask is about the correlation or the two-point function between the stress energy tensor and the twist operator. And it turns out that in this particular setup, where that's just a plane and this correlation function or this two-point function has a very well-defined form, and it's completely governed or fixed by the symmetry and conservation of the stress tensor. And so there's some kind of structure here, and there's an unknown coefficient. This is what's commonly called the scaling dimension of the operator. And it precisely matches the HN that we had on the previous transparency for two dimensions. However, in two dimensions, there's less structure, and there are less extra dimensions. In particular, there aren't dimensions parallel the twist operator, and so everything's encoded in this equation right here.
So these are holographic calculations to get those?
No, this is a CFT calculation. This is just a story that I could say in any CFT. And in fact, this doesn't have to be, a twist operator. People talk about surface operators in various contexts, and you would get the same story. And this would be the scaling dimension of the surface operator. Now let's go back and think about, again, the CFT story that I told before. But now I want to think about the Euclidean version of this conformal mapping.